Yeah, unknown book reviews by the young Byron, is that it?
No. This copy of the Couch of Eros, thanks to the tape ties, contained three documents which survived undisturbed in the book. One. Sir, we have a matter to settle. I wait on you in the gun room. E. Chater, Esquire. Two. My husband has sent to town for pistols. Deny what cannot be proven for charity's sake. I keep my room this day, unsigned. Three. Sidley Park, April the 11th, 1809. Sir, I call you a liar, a lecher, a slanderer in the press, and a thief of my honour. I wait upon your arrangements for giving me satisfaction as a man and a poet. E. Chater, Esquire.
Superb, but inconclusive. The book had 7 years to find its way into Byron's possession. It doesn't connect Byron with Chater, or with Sidley Park, or with Hodge, for that matter. Furthermore, there isn't a hint in Byron's letters. And this kind of scrape is the last thing he would have kept quiet about.
Scrape?
He would have made a comic turn out of it.
Comic turn? Fiddlesticks. He killed Chater.
Oh, really?
Chater was 31 years old, the author of 2 books. Nothing more is heard from him after Eros. He disappears completely after April 1809. And Byron had just published his satire, English Bards and Scotch Reviewers, in March. He was just getting a name, and yet he sailed for Lisbon as soon as he could find a ship and stayed abroad for 2 years. Hannah, this is fame. Somewhere in the Croom papers there will be something.
There isn't. I've looked.
But you were looking for something else. It's not going to jump out at you like Lord Byron remarked wittily at breakfast.
Nevertheless, it is unlikely his presence would have gone unremarked. But there is nothing to suggest that Byron was here, and I don't believe he ever was.
All right, let me have a look.
You queer my pitch.
My dear girl, I know how to handle myself.
And don't call me dear girl. If I find anything on Byron or Chater or Hodge, I'll pass it on. Nightingale, Sussex.
Thank you. I'm sorry about that business with my name.
Don't mention it.
What was Hodges College, by the way?
Trinity.
Trinity?
Yes. Yes! Byron's old college.
How old was Hodge?
I'd have to look it up, but a year or two older than Byron, 22.
Contemporaries at Trinity?
Yes, Bernard, and no doubt they were both in the cricket 11 when Harrow played Eton at Lord's.
Do you mean that Septimus Hodge was at school with Byron?
Yes. Yes, well, he must have been, as a matter of fact.
Well, you silly cow! Mm.
Oh, I thought I'd bring it to you.
I have to go and see about my car.
You're going to hide it?
Hide it? I'm going to sell it and find a pub to stay at in the village. Aren't you glad I'm here?
He said he knew you.
He couldn't have.
No, perhaps not. He said he wanted to be a surprise, but I suppose that's different. I thought there was a lot of sexual energy there, didn't you?
What?
Bouncy on his feet, you see. A sure sign. Should I invite him for you?
To what? No!
You can invite him. That's better. He can come as your partner.
Stop it. Thank you for the tea.
Well, if you don't want him, I'll have him. Is he married?
I haven't the slightest idea. Aren't you supposed to have a pony?
Just trying to fix you up, Hannah.
Believe me, it gets less important.
I mean, for the dancing. He can come as Beau Bryant.
I don't want to dress up, and I don't want a dancing partner. Least of all, Mr. Nightingale, I don't dance.
Don't be such a prune. You were kissing him anyway.
He was kissing me, and only out of general enthusiasm.
Well, don't say I didn't give you first chance. My genius brother will be much relieved. He's in love with you, I suppose you know.
That's a joke.
It's not a joke to him.
Of course it is. It's not even a joke. How can you be so ridiculous?
Hello, Gus. What have you got there? Oh, an apple.
Thank you.
Told you.
Thank you, Gus. Oh, dear.
There is no reply, Jellyby. Thank you.
I will say so to Mr. Chater.
But I will have something for the London Mail later. I'm nearly done.
Yes, Mr. Hawk.
Why have you stopped?
Solio incessor in igne. Seated on a throne, in the fire, and also on a ship. Sedebat Regina, sat the queen. The wind smelling sweetly. Corpores velis, by with or from purple sails, was like as to something. By with or from lovers. Oh, Septimus. Musica tibiarum imperabat. Music of pipes commanded...
Ruled is better.
The silver oars exciting the ocean as if amorous.
That is very good. Will you have a piece of my apple?
No, thank you.
Your loss is Plautus's gain. My tortoise is partial to a pippin.
Regina reclinabat. The queen was reclining. Quite a description. Indescribably in a golden tent. Like Venus and yet more.
Try to put some poetry into it.
How can I if there's none in the Latin?
Oh, a critic.
Is it Queen Dido?
No.
Who is the poet?
Known to you.
Known to me?
Not a Roman.
Mr. Chater.
Well, your translation is quite like Chater.
I know who it is. It is your friend, Byron.
Lord Byron, if you please.
Mama is in love with Lord Byron.
Yeah? Nonsense.
Not nonsense. I saw them together in the gazebo. Lord Byron was reading to her from his satire, and Mama was laughing with her head in her best position.
She did not understand the satire and was showing politeness to a guest.
Ah, she's vexed with Papa for his determination to alter the park. That alone cannot account for her politeness to a guest. She came downstairs hours before her custom. Lord Byron was amusing at breakfast. He paid you a tribute, Septimus.
Did he?
He said you were a witty fellow, and he had almost by heart an article you wrote about, well, I forget what, but it concerned a book called The Maid of Turkey, and how you would not give it to your dog for dinner.
Ah. Mr. Chater was at breakfast, of course.
He was. Certain lazy bones.
He does not have Latin to set and mathematics to correct. Excuse me, Plautus.
Correct? What was incorrect in it? Alpha minus. Pooh! What is the minus for?
For doing more than was asked.
You do not like my discovery.
A fancy is not a discovery.
A jibe is not a rebuttal. You are churlish with me because Mama is paying attention to your rent. Well, let them elope. They cannot turn back the advancement of knowledge. I think it is an excellent discovery. Each week, I plot your equations, dot for dot, x's against y's, in all manner of algebraical relation, and every week they draw themselves as commonplace geometry, As if the world of forms were nothing but arcs and angles. God's truth, Septimus. If there is an equation for a curve like a bell, there must be one for a curve like a bluebell. And if a bluebell, why not a rose? Do we believe nature is written in numbers?
We do.
Then why do your equations only describe the shapes of manufacture?
I do not know.
On thus, God could only make a cabinet.
He has mastery of equations which lead into infinities where we cannot follow.
What a faint heart. We must work outwards from the middle of the maze, and we will start with something simple. I will plot the leaf of this apple and deduce its equation. You will be famous for being my tutor when Lord Byron is dead and forgotten.
There. All done and ready for the post. Back to Cleopatra.
Is it Cleopatra? I hate Cleopatra.
You hate her? Why?
Well, everything is turned to love with her. New love, absent love, lost love. I never knew a heroine that makes such noodles of our sex. It only needs a Roman general to drop anchor outside the window, and away goes the empire like a christening mug into a pawn shop. If Queen Elizabeth had been a Ptolemy, history would have been quite different. We would be admiring the pyramids of Rome and the great Sphinx of Verona.
God save us.
But instead, the Egyptian noodle made carnal embrace with the enemy who burned the great library of Alexandria without so much as a fine for all that is overdue. Oh, Septimus, can you bear it? All the lost plays of the Athenians. There's 200 at least by Aeschylus, Sophocles, Euripides. Thousands of poems. Aristotle's own library brought to Egypt by the noodle's ancestors. And how can we sleep for grief?
By counting our stock. 7 plays from Aeschylus. 7 from Sophocles. 19 from Euripides, my lady. You should no more grieve for the rest than for a buckle lost from your first shoe, off your lesson book, which will be lost when you are old. We shed as we pick up, like travellers who must carry everything in their arms, and what we let fall will be picked up by those behind. The procession is very long, and life is very short. We die on the march, but there is nothing outside the march. So nothing can be lost to it. The missing plays of Sophocles will turn up, piece by piece, or be written again in another language. Ancient cures for diseases will reveal themselves once more. Mathematical discoveries glimpsed and lost to view will have their time again. You do not suppose, my lady, that if all of Archimedes had been hiding in the great library of Alexandria, we would be at a loss for a corkscrew? I have no doubt that the improved steam-driven heat engine, which puts Mr. Noakes into an ecstasy that he and it and the modern age should all coincide, was described on papyrus. Steam and brass were not invented in Glasgow. Now, where were we? Let me see if I can attempt a free translation for you. At Harrow, I was better at this than Lord Byron. Solio incessa in igne, sit it? Yes! The barge she sat in, like a burnished throne, burned on the water. The poop was beaten gold, purpled the sails, and, what's this? Ah, yes. So, a perfume.
You cheat!
Were lovesick with them. The oars were silver, which to the tune of flutes kept stroke,
cheat,
and made the
cheat,
water which they
cheat.
Beat to follow faster as amorous of their strokes. For her own person, it beggared all description. She did lie in her pavilion.
I hope you die!
Oh, good God, man, what have you told her?
Told her, Bryce?
Told her what?
Hodge!
My lady! Take her! My dear fellow, don't hang back out there. Come in, sir.
Captain Bryce does me the honour. I mean to say, sir, whatever you have to say to me, sir, address yourself to Captain Bryce.
How unusual. Captain Bryce, your wife did not appear yesterday, sir. I trust she is not sick.
My wife? I have no wife. What the devil do you mean, sir?
I do not understand the scheme, Chamber. Whom do I address when I mean to speak to Captain Bryce?
Oh, slippery, Hodge, slippery.
By the way, Chater, I have some amazing news to tell you. Someone has taken to writing wild and whirling letters in your name. I received one not half an hour ago.
Mr. Hodge, look to your honour, sir. If you cannot attend to me without this foolery, nominate your second who might settle the business as between gentlemen. No doubt your friend Byron would do you the service.
Oh, yes, he would do me the service. Mr. Chater, sir, I repent your injury. You are an honest fellow with no more malice in you than poetry.
Ah, well, that is more like the thing. Is he apologizing?
There is still the injury to his conjugal property. Mrs. Chater's...
Tush, sir.
As you will, her tush. Nevertheless...
Excellently found. Mr. Chater, this will please you very much. Lord Byron begs a copy of your new poem. He dies to read it and intends to include your name in the second edition of his English Bards and Scotch Reviewers.
English Bards and Scotch Reviewers, your ladyship is a doggerel aimed at Lord Byron's seniors and betters. If he intends to include me, he intends to insult me.
Well, of course he does, Mr. Chater. Would you rather be thought not worth insulting? You should be proud to be in the company of Rogers and Moore and Wordsworth. Ah, the couch of Eros. Oh,
that's mine, copy, madam.
So much the better. What are a friend's books for, if not to be borrowed? Mr. Hodge, you must speak to your friend, Lord Byron, and put him out of his affectation of pretending to quit us. I will not have it. He says he is determined on the Malta packet sailing out of Falmouth. His head is full of Lisbon and Lesbos, and his portmanteau of pistols. And I've told him it is not to be thought of. The whole of Europe is in a Napoleonic fit. All the best ruins will be closed. The roads entirely occupied with the movement of armies. The lodgings turned to billets. And the fashion for godless republicanism not yet arrived at its natural reversion. He says his aim is poetry. One does not aim at poetry with pistols. At poets, perhaps. I charge you to take command of his pistols, Mr. Hodge. He is not safe with them. His lameness, he confessed to me, is entirely the result of his habit from boyhood of shooting himself in the foot. What is that noise?
The new Broadwood pianoforte, madam. Our music lessons are at an early stage.
Well, restrict your lessons to the piano side of the instrument and let her loose on the forte when she's learned, sir.
Now, if that was not God speaking through Lady Croom, he never spoke through anyone.
Take command of Lord Byron's pistols.
You hear, Mr. Chater, sir? How will you answer him?
By killing him. I'm tired of him. Hey? Oh, damn your soul, Chater. Ovid would have stayed a lawyer and Virgil a farmer if they had known the bathos to which love would descend in your sportive satyrs and noodle nymphs. I'm at your service with a half-ounce ball in your brain. May it satisfy you? Behind the boathouse at daybreak, shall we say 5 o'clock? My compliments to Mrs. Chater. Have no fear for her. She will not want for protection while Captain Bryce has a guinea in his pocket. He told us so himself.
You lie, sir.
No, sir. Mrs. Chater, perhaps.
You lie or you will answer to me.
Oh, very well. I can fit you in at 5 minutes after 5. Then it's off to the Malta packet out of Falmouth. You two will be dead. My penurious school friend will remain to tutor Lady Thomasina, and I trust everybody, including Lady Croom, will be sacrificed.
He is all bluster and bladder. Rest assured, Chater, I will let the air out of him.
Oh, but Captain Bryce?
Thomasina Coverley have found a truly wonderful method whereby all the forms of nature must give up their numerical secrets and draw themselves through number alone. This margin being too mean for my purpose, the reader must look elsewhere for the new geometry of irregular forms discovered by Thomasina Coverley, her algebra primer. Does it mean anything?
I don't know. In her lesson book, there's this iterated algorithm.
Oh, what's that?
Well, it's... Jesus, it's an algorithm that's been iterated. Am I supposed to... the left-hand pages are graphs of what the numbers are doing on the right-hand pages. But all on different scales. Each graph is a small section of the previous one blown up. Like you've got the detail of a photograph. And then a detail of the detail, and so on. Forever. Or in her case, till she ran out of pages.
Is it difficult?
Well, maths isn't difficult. It's what you did at school. You have some x and y equation. Any value for x gives you a value for y. So you put a dot where it's right for both x and y. Then you take your next value for x, which gives you another value for y. When you've done that a few times, you join up the dots, and that's your graph of whatever the equation is.
And is that what she's doing?
No, not exactly. Not at all. What she's doing is, every time she works out a value for y, she's using that as her next value for x, and so on. Like a feedback. She's feeding the solution back into the equation, and then solving it again. Iteration, you see.
And that's surprising, is it?
Well, it is a bit. It's the technique I'm using on my Gauss numbers, and it hasn't been around for much longer than... well, call it 20 years.
Why would she be doing it?
I have no idea. Thought you were doing the hermit.
Oh, I am. I still am. But Bernard, damn him. Thomasina's tutor turns out to have interesting connections. Bernard's going through the library like a bloodhound. This portfolio is in one of the top cupboards.
There's a lot of stuff around. Gus is always digging about in it. No old masters or anything.
This maths primer she was using belonged to him. The tutor. He wrote his name in it.
Septimus Hodge.
Yes. Why were these things saved, do you think?
Why? Should there be a reason?
And this diagram. What's it of?
How would I know?
Why are you cross?
I'm not cross. When your Thomasina was doing maths, it had been the same maths for a couple of thousand years. Classical. Then, a century after Thomasina, maths left the real world behind. Just like modern art, really. Nature was classical. Maths was suddenly Picasso's. But now, nature is having the last laugh. The freaky stuff is turning out to be the mathematics of the natural world.
This feedback thing?
For example.
Well, why couldn't that be the new geometry of
because
a regular
Because he bloody
form?
Couldn't.
All right, you're not cross. But what do you mean you are doing the same thing she was doing? What are you doing?
Actually, I'm doing it from the other end. She started with an equation and turned it into a graph. I got the graph. Real data. And I'm trying to find the equation which would give you the graph if you used it the way she's used hers. Iterated it.
What for?
It's how we mathematicians look at population changes in biology. Goldfish in a pond, say. This year there are X goldfish, next year there'll be Y goldfish. Some get born, some get eaten by herons, whatever. Nature manipulates the X and turns it into Y. Then Y goldfish is your starting population for the following year. Just like Thomasina, your value for Y becomes your next value for X. The question is, what is being done to X? What is the manipulation? Whatever it is, it can be written down as mathematics. It's called an algorithm.
It can't be the same every year.
Details change. You can't keep tabs on everything. It's not nature in a box. But it isn't necessary to know the details. When they're all put together, it turns out the population is obeying a mathematical rule.
The goldfish are?
Yes. No. The numbers. It's not about the behaviour of fish, it's about the behaviour of numbers. This thing works for any phenomenon which eats its own numbers. Measles epidemics, rainfall averages, cotton prices. It's a natural phenomenon in itself. Spooky.
Does it work for grouse?
I don't know yet. I mean, it does, undoubtedly. But it's hard to show. There's more noise with grouse.
Noise?
Distortions. Interference. Real data is messy. There's 1,000 acres of moorland that had grouse on it. Always dipped at about 1930. But nobody counted the grouse. They shot them. So you count the grouse they shot. But burning the heather interferes. It improves the food supply. A good year for foxes interferes the other way. They eat the chicks. And then there's the weather. It's all very, very noisy out there. Very hard to spot the tune. Like a piano in the next room. It's playing your song, but unfortunately, it's out of whack. Some of the strings are missing, and the pianist is tone deaf and drunk. I mean, the noise. Impossible.
What do you do?
You start guessing what the tune might be. You try to pick it out of the noise. You try this, you try that. You start to get something. It's half-baked, but you start putting in notes which are missing, or not quite the right notes, and bit by bit.
Dum-de-dum-dum, dear Valentine. Dum-de-dum-dum to you.
The lost algorithm.
I see. Then what?
I publish.
Of course. Sorry. Jolly good.
That's the theory. Grouse are bastards compared to goldfish.
Why did you choose them?
The game books. My true inheritance. 200 years of real data on a plate.
Somebody wrote down everything that's shot.
Well, that's what a game book is. I'm only using from 1870 when Butts and Beaters came in.
You mean the game books go back to Thomasina's time?
Oh, yeah, fun. No, really, that's mad. I promise you. Not a schoolgirl living in a country house in Derbyshire in 18-something.
Well, what was she doing?
She was just playing with the numbers. The truth is, she wasn't doing anything.
She must have been doing something.
Doodling. Nothing she understood.
A monkey at a typewriter.
Yeah. Well, a piano. Mm.
A method whereby all the forms of nature must give up their numerical secrets and draw themselves through number alone. This feedback thing, is it a way of making pictures of forms in nature? Just tell me if it is or it isn't.
To me it is. Pictures of turbulence, growth, change, creation. It's not a way of drawing an elephant, for God's sake.
I'm sorry. So, you couldn't make a picture of this apple leaf by iterating a what's-it?
Yes, you could do that.
Well, tell me. Honestly, I could kill you.
If you knew the algorithm and fed it back, say, 10,000 times, each time there'd be a dot somewhere on the screen. You'd never know where to expect the next dot. But gradually, you'd start to see this shape. because every dot would be inside the shape of this leaf. It wouldn't be a leaf. It would be a mathematical object. But yes, the unpredictable and the predetermined unfold together to make everything the way it is. Makes me so happy to be at the beginning again, knowing almost nothing. People were talking about the end of physics, relativity and quantum, but they only explain the very big and the very small, the universe, the elementary particles, the ordinary-sized stuff which is our lives, the stuff people write poetry about, clouds, daffodils, waterfalls, and what happens in a cup of coffee when the cream goes in. These things are full of mystery, as mysterious to us as the heavens were to the Greeks. We're better at predicting events at the edge of the galaxy or inside the nucleus of an atom than whether it'll rain on Auntie's garden party 3 Sundays from now. Because the problem turns out to be different. We can't even predict the next drip from a dripping tap when it gets irregular. Each drip sets up the conditions for the next. The smallest variation blows prediction apart. And the weather is unpredictable the same way. Will always be unpredictable. When you push the numbers through the computer, you can see it on the screen. The future is disorder. A door like this has cracked open 5 or 6 times since we got up on our hind legs. It's the best possible time to be alive, when almost everything you thought you knew is wrong.
The weather is fairly predictable in the Sahara.
The scale is different, but the graph goes up and down the same way. 6,000 years in the Sahara looks like 6 months in Manchester, I bet you.
How much?
Everything you have to lose.
No.
Quite right. That's why there was corn in Egypt.
What is he playing?
Gus, dunno. He makes it up.
Chloe called him genius.
That's what my mother calls him. And she means it. Last year, some expert had her digging in the wrong place for months, trying to find something or other. The foundations for Capability Brown's boathouse. And Gus put her right first go.
Did he ever speak?
Oh, yes. Until he was 5. You've never asked about him. You get high marks here for good breeding.
Oh, yes. I've always been given credit for my unconcern. And when I feel sorry, I'm a head and there when we... Ani ar gor cair farfen, edrych o ddar naen. Orfan weld yn codi, a fi fwyd o goed yn fi. Roedd a'i sort i'r hanes,
I'm a head. Arlog with the tale of the old Carmarthen Oak. And that's where we leave these musical islands for another week. My name's Jim Lloyd, producer Charles Clark Maxwell, and we hope you'll join us again next week at the same time here in the World Service of the BBC to hear more of the traditional music of the British Isles. Goodbye. This week we start our musical journey around the British Isles with a dance. Sort of dance that can be found in your homes all over England. The setting here is the mythical village of Of Paula Thompson's book based on her own childhood in Oxfordshire in the late 19th century. Our first song this week come from the north of England. The Tinker is a little song which was first written down by John Bell of Annick in 1812. And before that we hear Elsie Marley. The song Elsie Marley was published in 1784 being a choice collection of excellent songs relating to the variety and Elsie Marley was a real person. She was the wife of the landlord of the Swan, a public house of Picktree near Chesterfield. Welcome to these musical islands in the World Service of the BBC. My name's Jim Lloyd. This week, our musical journey around the British Isles takes us to the East Midlands to meet the Tuppers. We go walking on the Pennines, hear about a sea monster, and end up in a pub in Wales. But we start in the Hebrides, the islands off the northwest coast of Scotland. Step brigade on we go, heel for heel and toe for toe, arm and row and row for Mary's wedding. Step brigade on we go, heel for heel and toe for toe, arm and row for Mary's wedding. Over hillways up and down, myrtle green and bracken brown, past the shealing through the town, all for sake of Mary. Step, we gaily on we go, heel for heel and toe for toe,
arm in arm and row on row over Mary's wedding. Redder cheeks as Rowan's are, brighter eyes as any star. Fairest of them all by far is our darling Mary. Step to gaily on we go, in for haven, go for trouble. Arm in arm and row all for Mary's wedding. 20 herring, 20 meal, 20 pitted filler creel, 20 bonny bairns as well, that's a cost for Mary. Step to gaily on we go, in for heel and toe for toe, arm in arm and row all for Mary's wedding. Step to gaily on we go, in for heel and toe for toe, arm in arm and row all for Mary's wedding.
With the Lewis Bridal Song. From the Hebrides down to Cheshire in the northwest of England. In the year 1636, Martin Parker, a local poet, was inspired to write some verses on the subject of a fish-like monster which had been cast up on the shores of the Wirral, a peninsula between the estuaries of the River Mersey and the River Dee. He called his poem The Miraculous Fish.
There's many marvels in me time, I've heard of once or more, but there's a stranger now in prime that's lately come on shore. It's a fish, a monstrous fish, but now it's dead as we would wish. Oh, beyond the head, in England never like. A man on horseback has destroyed, within its mouth may stand 12 yoke of oxen stout and strong, can't shift it from the sand. Such secrets close doth Neptune keep, within the bosom of the deep. Oh, rare, beyond compare, beyond compare, in England never like. His pistle is 4 yards in length, wide as man's waist is broad. His sinews are of such a strength, that make a riding rod. Already 16 tons of oil from out this fish you have seen to boil. Oh, rare, beyond compare, in England never like. His cods are like to hogsheads great, which seemeth past belief. But men of credit can relate what I describe in brief. Then let with charity confess, God's works are more than man can guess. Oh, rare, beyond compare, when he upon the sands was cast, a line which was a while, he yelled aloud that men aghast heard him up on 6 miles. 'Tis said the female fish likewise was heard to mourn with horrid cries. Oh, rare, in England never like. Not in a chest to say a herring of his name. What there be for certain they that are for knowledge famed, affirm the like in ages past, upon our coast was never cast. Oh,
The Miraculous Fish. And it was said that for some time after the death of that fish, the people living on the Wirral could hear his mate out at sea bewailing her loss. Graham and Eileen Pratt were the singers there. Have you ever been to the East Midlands of England, Nottinghamshire and South Yorkshire, just before Christmas? You may still see artist children out singing. They'll go round the pubs of an evening with one of their number disguised under a blanket as a duck, or in Derbyshire, a ram. Indeed, if you know about the Derby ram, you may recognise some of the verses from this Tuffers song.